And do we have cross? We don't have cross appeals here. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
And just a housekeeping matter, I see my time set for 10. I believe I have 15 minutes and 5 for rebuttal.
You should, if that's what you told them. I have no idea what you have, other than 20 at the outset until we start asking questions, and then it'll turn into 40 or 50, who knows. All right, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. The PhD is the highest academic degree that Texas State awards. Like the university's other degrees, it is a Texas State's representation to the academic community, to employers, and to the public that the recipient has met the standards and conditions set by the university for such a degree. Concurrent, which is statutory authority to set the conditions for a degree, defendants also has the authority to revoke a degree when, as is the case here, the recipient is found to have violated those conditions by obtaining the degree through fraud. Anything less would undermine public confidence in Texas State degrees. In this lawsuit, plaintiff challenges the 2014 revocation of her degree, but her claims fail for two reasons. First, plaintiff's claims fail because they are impermissibly retrospective in nature, as the requested relief would necessarily require the undoing of a past completed administrative action. Second, plaintiff's claims also fail because defendants did not act ultra vires, because it had the authority to revoke a degree in this scenario, and because it provided plaintiff more than sufficient process. Well, because both of these grounds are jurisdictional.
Counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I read that an action was brought before the action revoking the degree. Am I wrong? In this case, was there an action that was stayed or dismissed because it was premature?
Well, the original petition in this action, this clause number, was filed in 2015 after the revocation of the degree. Okay. And certainly the live petition, the third amended petition, occurred years after the revocation of the degree.
Okay. But and no monetary relief is being sought, right?
That is correct.
And so you're suggesting that what they're asking for, though, is to overturn a prior decision. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So because both of these grounds, both the retrospective nature of the action and the authority, the Ultra Vires Act, are jurisdictional, they both constitute independent grounds for this court to reach a decision, so it can reach a decision on both or either in reversing and rendering this case.
So you're saying reinstatement from today forward, from the date of, like if this court were to issue the judgment saying, nope, she gets to be reinstated, wouldn't that just be from today forward? It's not necessarily going back and reinstating her.
But it would require, and to start first with that,
August of 2014. We're not going back and postdating it to August 2014. We would be doing, any judgment would be effective when this court's mandate issues.
But the key point is it would necessarily require going back in time and undoing the decision to revoke the degree, which is final and completed.
But Mr. Soto, in the earlier suit, the state argued that it was unripe, and we've just heard an earlier argument where the state is saying, well, your degree has not yet been revoked, so that's unripe, and then you are standing here saying, well, after it's been revoked, then that's retrospective. So under your view or the state's view, then you can never review a degree revocation because it's either not ripe or it's retrospective.
Our position is, and in our case, ripeness is not an issue, but yes, the standard for a suit against a state is sovereign immunity bars the claim, right, unless there is a exception or unless that has been expressly waived. And what we are saying is not that there cannot be other claims, but that in an ultra vires context, you cannot reach back in time and undo a past administrative action. And this court has already spoke on this exact issue in the 2017 SO opinion. Okay. There, the court, in finding that the claims can go forward on the disciplinary action, found that, and I quote, once the university officials have conducted the degree revocation hearing, SO may no longer have a claim for prospective relief to enjoin the hearing that is not barred by sovereign immunity.
The right. I think we're all familiar. I think everyone here is very familiar with SO in terms of how procedurally different, though, that is than our situation here.
And this exact question. In the reasoning in SO, it stated that once this proceeding has been completed, once the degree is revoked, SO would no longer have an ultra vires action.
Okay, so then there's no recourse at all?
Through an ultra vires claim.
Okay, so that would be then what would that look like? What would SO be able to do?
Well, certainly they could not bring an ultra vires action to undo that action. And that's clear from Heinrich. That's clear from this court's decision in American Youth Works, which was also a revocation case. And that's also clear from the court's reasoning in SO. And it starts from the position that to assert a claim that falls within the ultra vires exception to immunity, among other requirements, a claim must not be retrospective in nature. And this court in American Youth Works held that a claim is impermissibly retrospective in nature if it would necessarily involve going back in time to undo a past administrative action.
Well, isn't there some language in that talked about the ongoing process and something like that as well? Or
so if this was a different case with a different factual scenario, maybe there could be a continuing violation. But here, there's no allegation and no evidence that there's any future action by the university related to this proceeding. All the actions related by the university and defendants completed in August of 2014. So there's no further action to enjoin. That's why any relief or any remedies they could seek through the ultra vires action would be impermissibly retrospective, because it would necessarily require undoing that past, either declarations that the university has violated actions in the past, or an injunction that would require the university to change its decision in 2014 that her degree was revoked.
But isn't every time someone calling Texas State University and asking whether or not her degree is revoked, and every time Texas State says, yes, it's revoked, isn't that an ongoing?
There is nothing ultra vires about answering a question. There's nothing ultra vires in that context. All the alleged ultra vires action in this case has already completed. Now, plaintiffs allege that there is ongoing harm from those actions, but that's the case in every single, but that's simply not the rule for ultra vires cases, and that's not what the court considered in Heinrich, that's not what the Supreme Court considered in Williams, and that's not what this court has ever considered as far as what constitutes a continuing violation. And if the court were to depart from that and find that that would constitute a continuing violation, that exception would swallow the rule. Virtually every concrete injury that someone could have that could give rise to a lawsuit will have some continuing impact. The Williams plaintiffs, which was a Texas Supreme Court case where the ultra vires conduct was a lump sum pension payment that they alleged was impermissibly small, not receiving that money surely had ongoing consequences. In American Youth Works, the charter revocation case, the charter schools not having a charter clearly had ongoing harm. That's simply not the rule. This court in that case said that claim was impermissibly retrospective, even if they couch it in prospective terms, as the plaintiffs did in that case by saying in future appeals and future revocation appeals, we want an injunction. The court said that's impermissible because it would require undoing past acts. So too here. Here, all the actions that the university took is undisputedly final and completed. And what I think makes this clear is the actual proposed remedies that the plaintiff in this case seek, and that's at the record starting at 542. They seek declarations that the university officials have in the past violated their constitutional rights and acted, again, using the past tense, outside of their authority. That shows their declarations are necessarily dependent on a declaration that defendants have done something in the past that is illegal. Their injunctive relief is essentially that the degree be reinstated, again, requiring making clear that their claims rest on undoing this 2014 decision that the university made. That is impermissibly retrospective, that is barred by Heinrich, that is barred by Williams, and this court's prior opinions in American Youth Works, Progresso, and even in the SO appeal, the reasoning in the SO appeal. But even if that were not the case, The university, the claims are still barred by sovereign immunity because KE has not pleaded and cannot prove that the defendants acted ultra vires. And here there are two ultra vires claims.
And I think that that's where, you know, yeah, let's move into that. Where do we get the authority to, for the university to engage in the action that it did, to actually revoke?
Both by its rules, both by starting first with the statutes and flowing from that its rules, which it expressly allows for revocation.
So the statute doesn't say, the statute says that you can confer degrees. It doesn't say that you can take them away, does it?
It actually says a little bit more than that. It says that they have the authority to set conditions for the award of the degree.
Sure.
And one of those conditions is that the student achieve that degree honestly and not essentially not commit fraud to obtain that degree or obtain that through mistake.
Okay, so then same question as you heard earlier. Why is the degree process itself, the doctoral degree process, why is that insufficient to assure that the degree was not obtained outside of the conditions that the university had imposed?
Because sometimes, for one reason or another, the information that gives rise to the university knowing that the person achieved it by mistake or fraud or dishonesty doesn't arise till after that process. And to be clear, we are not asking for a rule that says for any reason that the university can revoke a degree. We are the Texas State's rules that expressly allows for this specifically cabins it to fraud, dishonesty, or mistake. So we're not saying that we could go back and look at your freshman paper and just because we changed our mind on whether that's an A or a B, now suddenly you don't graduate. It is for degrees that do not meet the terms, the conditions, which the legislature expressly granted Texas State to be able to set. When they don't meet those conditions through fraud, dishonesty, or mistake, that after due process, the university can revoke.
I'm assuming you were listening to the questions from the earlier case, and I cannot find my, but I think the case is the one out of Pittsburgh, the one out of Kent State, where they talk about those, that they have their implied, or they allow the implied ability to revoke for things like fraud, things like that, where the degree was erroneously conferred. What about those cases where they just say, oh, it's just, you know, good cause? What do you think
clear,
about that?
In this case, in our rules, we are asking for a decision saying in this scenario where it has been essentially wrongly conferred because KE falsified data, was found to have falsified data that led to her dissertation. That is a violation of the conditions that Texas State set for its degree and essentially was erroneously conferred due that. So that is what we're asking here. That's all the court needs to decide in this case.
Mr. Soto, what about the other language in 9521, and perform other such acts as in the judgment of the board contributes to the development of the universities and the system or the welfare of their students?
I think that speaks to the broad grant of authority that the legislature set for the system and for the Board of Regents in order to promulgate rules. And it is not the case that that most people, when they graduate, have no connection to the university. Your connection to the university is through that degree and what that degree stands for. And whether it's employers looking at an application and seeing you've graduated from the University of Texas, that or Texas State, that has to mean something. And that means something only if the university has the authority to enforce its statutory grant to set conditions for the award.
And how far back can they go?
Well, in this case, it was 4 months after the degree was awarded. But I think
you're asking this court to create, potentially, arguably create and write in a portion of the statute giving y'all the ability to revoke, because it's not expressly there. Do you concede that?
I concede that
there's not express language
saying that we can revoke a degree.
Correct. So you're asking us to be the first court to do so. So how we do it, I think, would matter if this court is going to create that exception for y'all.
And I think the key part of that is that it has to comply with due process because they have a property right in that degree. So the longer the university gets from when the degree is issued, that raises more due process concerns.
What about the argument that you can't get due process when you're not before something like a neutral and detached, court that's not necessarily affected? Y'all's process started in 2001. You did, one committee inquiry in 2012. You did committee findings in 2013. You did responses. You did hearings in 2014. You did findings. Finally, you go to the board. I mean, y'all had a lot of process. There's no question about that. But was any portion of it ever outside the Texas state system?
So before
2014?
No, but what I would say to that is that universities all the time afford process. They do it in student disciplinary proceedings for students. They do it in Title IX contexts. They do it in revocations of tenure. This happens all the time at public universities across the state of Texas. And courts have never said in a tenure revocation proceeding that just because it's handled by the university that due process that violates due process. That has certainly not ever been a holding that any Texas court has held, and certainly plaintiffs don't cite any holding to that effect. And I see that my time is up.
You have some time left, I'm assuming, yes.
Hey, please, court. Heads I win, tails you lose. I'm glad these cases were set together today because you've seen exactly what the state of Texas thinks. They think two ladies who achieved a PhD from two different universities are in different procedural contexts with an undoubted constitutional property right have no recourse outside the university system, even though those ladies are no longer students. They're no longer faculty. We are going to hail a private citizen into court. We're going to hail a private citizen into an administrative proceeding before a university faculty committee. And we're going to apply rules to them that, by their very terms, apply only to students and to faculty. We're not going to give them any impartial magistrate. We're not going to give them any right to appeal. And we're here today telling this court that there's no recourse, even though that constitutional right's been violated. That's wrong, just a matter of public policy, but it's wrong as a legal matter as well. And my goal today is to give you a roadmap through the legal process of how you can write the opinion affirming the trial court, because the roadmap's actually pretty straightforward. Now, I want to talk about, before I get there, what we're not here to decide. We're not here to decide if KE committed academic misconduct. Not before the court. We're not here to decide if Texas State was correct in finding that she committed academic misconduct. Again, it's not before the court. I also want to clarify the standard of review, because one thing the state never mentions in their brief is the standard of review for when you're reviewing the pleadings and the evidence in this case is that you have to read them in favor of KE if there's a dispute. That's very important. It's going to be important to your analysis. Now, the roadmap. But before I get there, I do want to talk about the fact that this is a big case for this court. I mean, this is going to have ripple effects for decades. It's the first case. Right now, we're talking about academic misconduct. I predict in a few years from now, we'll be talking about things like hate speech. We'll be talking about things like untoward advances toward the opposite sex. All the different things that might come up 20 years down the line that someone tweeted about in 2019. This case is going to have ripple effects. Make no bones about it. And sitting there in the audience listening to one of your own prior opinions get picked on a little bit, and you start questioning your own draftsmanship, you realize the importance of the words you choose. And I feel for you on this one. It's going to have ripple effects. So let's unpack the claims. What are KE's claims, first of all? Because the state's brief, if you go back to your chambers and start writing this opinion, the state's brief only mentions one of our claims, the ultravirus claim. There's two claims here. And they knew it because their plea of the jurisdiction said so. The brief didn't. There's an ultra-virus claim. There's also a separate UDGA claim for a violation of constitutional rights. And the case law is very clear on this, in Patel, in American Youth Works, and on and on and on. That's a separate claim, and that's a separate immunity issue. If you can show a viable constitutional claim, there is no immunity. So I'm going to get to both of these. We're going to talk about ultravirus first, because I think that's what we've been talking about so far. I'm going to cross that bridge first. But here's the basic roadmap. If you find there's no authority to revoke the degree, KE wins so long as she shows that she's seeking prospective relief. That's the very basics of ultravirus.
And so how is reinstatement not undoing the prior decision?
So your question earlier got it exactly right. Reinstatement is prospective relief. Ultravirus conduct is about an injunction that goes from the point of the injunction forward. Look at Heinrich. Heinrich's the seminal case on ultravirus in Texas. Heinrich, what did it do? It reinstated pension benefits. It found that the pension board was unlawfully withholding pension benefits. That's a past decision. That's a past wrong. How did they remedy it? They made an injunction giving the plaintiff the pension benefits she was entitled to going forward. And interestingly, in Heinrich, they even gave her back benefits too. I'm still to this day not quite sure how they got there, but it really doesn't matter for our case. For our case, they recognize pension benefits going forward. Now, here's what else is interesting about Heinrich. And I hadn't really noticed it until I was preparing for this argument. They analogize and basically, I don't want to say adopt, but they with favor look at federal law. Now, federal doesn't call it ultravirus. Federal, you have the 11th Amendment immunity, and you have to show that you're seeking wrongful, unlawful state action that goes beyond their authority. It's basically ultravirus, and you have to show that you're seeking prospective relief. They cite Ex parte Young, which is an early 1900s U.S. Supreme Court case. Look at where Ex parte Young has gone in the federal system. Look at the Nelson case through the Fifth Circuit. This is a perfect case to look at. The Nelson case, I'm going to get you a cite. The Nelson case is 535 F3rd 318. Question of employment in that case. And there was a way that it became basically an ultravirus case. Reinstatement of employment was the remedy there. And they said under Ex parte Young, this is forward seeking relief. This is, and they basically, and I love the way they put it, they said, if you were deciding whether something's prospective or retrospective, you look from the day of the injunction. Mm-hmm. That's all it means. But Justice Kelly, you asked another question about prospective relief, and you hit number two on the list of potential prospective relief here. And I think it's fairly within our pleadings, and if it's not, we get to go back and cure any defect in our pleadings. So there's definitely no way, by the way, let me get this out of the way right now. There's no way these pleadings show an incurable jurisdictional defect. The worst that should happen to KE is a remand for repleting. But let's come back to that later. But Justice Kelly, I want to address your concern. They put in their brief, well, what we could always do is just interface with the public and tell them we no longer recognize this degree. In fact, that exists. There's a website where employers and other people, they check with universities to find records to see whether a degree is in good standing. That also is prospective relief. They're talking about future conduct, which we get to enjoin if they acted unlawfully in revoking this degree. Now let's come back to the authority question, because we don't even get to prospective retrospective if there's authority. I think we had it established in the opening that there's no express authority. Okay, I think fairly we know that, right? And we know that for many reasons. Look, 50 years ago the AG ruled on this. I know it's not binding on this court, but it's the only time in Texas it's been ruled on. 50 years. And if you look back at the statute that they were interpreting, is Article 2585, it says you have the power to confer degrees and grant diplomas. If you fast forward 50 years, what does our statute say now? You have the power to determine the condition of awards for certificates and diplomas.
What about the other language that says, and perform in 9521, and perform other such acts as in the judgment of the board contributes to the development of the universities in the system or the welfare of their students? How is revoking a degree for academic dishonesty not affecting the welfare of the current students at UT or I'm sorry, at Texas State are not within this broad power?
First of all, that assumes that a current student would be affected by that at all. And we're talking about a private citizen whose rights are at stake. Current students aren't going to have a clue that this is going on. It affects them zero. But 9521 is actually about rules. When do we get to pass rules? And Texas State has a rule giving them the right to revoke, which, by the way, I'm going to show you, is another ultra-virus act on their part. Because if you look at 9521, there's two parts. The first part says you have the authority to promulgate rules for the operation, control, and management of the university system as you deem necessary and desirable. That's broad. That's like absolute authority. But if you look at the next sentence, that basically if you don't fit within that, then you look at the next sentence, when power is vested in the board, you get to pass the rest. There has to be power vested in the board. Who vests power on the board? The legislature. There's no authority for this rule. If that's the case, why can't they make a rule saying anything? And think about that. This isn't your normal state agency. There's no public notice. There's no comment. There's no Texas Register. There's no ability under 2001-038 to challenge the rule. We're just going to let universities decide whatever rule they want to put. And we can just say, hey, it's for the welfare of the students. It's always for the kids, right? I'm joking. But you can't do that. Otherwise, the university, its academics run amok. They're going to make up whatever rules they want and really affect the lives. And we can't forget we're talking about a private citizen. Cannot forget that. So they don't have authority.
What about in those kinds of proceedings, and you were here, you were listening to the earlier questions, what about in those proceedings where there is a showing that the degree was obtained by fraud? I mean, where there is something along those lines. Not getting to the merits of whether or not that is true in this particular case, but does a university have the ability, when they're faced with a degree that was conferred by fraud, to go back? Do they have recourse? And
yes.
If so, what is it?
In a court of law. They absolutely have recourse in a court of law. They can sue. And look, it's not a hardship for them. There is no statute of limitations for the state. I mean, that's not lost on me. They could go back 20 years from now and seek remedies in court. It's the only way you get to an impartial arbiter. You asked the question during the SO, what would that look like? Deck action. That's the simplest form. Fraud. Now, we wouldn't necessarily have a contract in every case, but some you will. There are a number of ways to have this decided in a court of law with an impartial arbiter rather than a committee of faculty members who know the complainant, who then investigate for the complainant, and then decide whether the degree is going to be revoked. And then we get an appeal to the president and the Board of Regents as if they aren't going to support their own faculty members. Think about every context. The only context I can think of is charter schools, where we don't allow court intervention, and there it's because there was no vested property right. But think about licensing. Think about any professional license you can think of. How does that work? You have an agency, usually, where someone makes a complaint, it goes through the agency process, and then there is court review of it. There's always an ending, and there's always an ending before an impartial arbiter. You can't have due process without an impartial arbiter, and you can't have due process with rules applying on an ad hoc basis. Hey, we're going to take some rules that apply to students, even though you're not one, and we're going to take some rules that apply to tenured faculty, even though you're not one of those either. Think about that. This is constitutional rights at stake, and they're making up the rules as they go. That's the problem with the legislature not conferring this authority on Texas State. If the legislature, and Mr. Gibbon, I think you asked this question earlier, the implication from that question was, well, wait, don't we normally have legislative guidance here of what the agency can do, what the rules are? Exactly. If this were a right conferred on the university, the legislature would clearly set forth the process that they could invoke rules, that they have to, usually what happens is they'll come up with something saying, and you have to, we're giving you this right, and you have to come up with rules, agency or university, that govern this type of proceeding. They don't have it because it's never been done. They don't have it because it's never been done. I do want to point out a couple of other cases to you that are good to read. Back to reinstatement being a proper remedy, the Alcorn case out of the First Court of Appeals is 877 Southwest 2nd 390. It collects cases about reinstatement being prospective relief for an ultra-virus case. I forgot to point that out earlier when we were talking about that. Now let's look at the second cause, which they didn't talk about in their briefing. And that is, do we have a viable constitutional claim here? And I think I've already outlined some of the reasons we do. And I'll tell you, I honestly think, given the standard review is that you have to read the pleadings in our favor and the evidence in our favor, I think that's it. I think case over. We're remanding for a proceedings in the trial court on the claims. But the question is there a viable due process claim? If you wonder about the dichotomy between the two claims, look at American Youth Works. This court did a wonderful job in that case of outlining the constitutional issues and how they were different. This isn't an ultra-virus claim. This is a question of, is there a fact issue about due process? Once you decide that that's where you are, that's when you look at Thann. Thann does outline the three considerations that you look at when you're formulating what processes do. Now, Thann is very different than our case, right? All that was at issue at Thann was a liberty interest for a current student. And basically, the court said, this kind of academic charge is really a misconduct charge for a current student. And really, the liberty interest at stake is basically the stigma that comes along with that. Not a high constitutional right we're talking about at that point. And that's why they looked at the process the way they did in Thann. But they outlined the factors that you have to balance. The private interest affected, the risk of erroneous deprivation through the process used versus adding other safeguards, and then the governmental interest, including any burden on the government. Number one, the private interest affected swamps the other ones here. We're talking about, now here, and that's the problem, right? You're writing a court of appeals opinion. It's not limited to someone. You can't say, well, here we are 6 months after the PhD. Well, SO, we're talking about 4 years. What's the next case going to be, 25 years? Could be. But you're going to have to balance those factors in deciding how much process is due. This court's opinion does not have to go that far in saying exactly what processes do. Ultimately, you can send that back to the trial court as long as there's a fact issue about whether more process was due. That, again, is your issue. And
I think that do you disagree with the state of the record showing that there were hearings and committees and findings and responses and formal charges and more findings and over the course of from November 2011 to August 2014?
Yes. It looked like to me when you're trying a case and you got a legal issue, you're arguing to the trial court, and they keep saying, any other objections, Mr. Field? Anything else you want to say before we rule? That's what it looked like. They'd already made up their mind. They knew what they were going to do. But let's give you as much process as we possibly can within our system. The problem is, no matter how much they did within the university system, again, it comes back to, was there ever an impartial arbiter? I believe it has to go to court. I really do. I think that's the answer.
So you're on where I was at. The question that I was asking is, how can you ever have due process when it's all within the university system?
You can't.
How is it different from tenure? How is it different from those types of?
Because tenure is current faculty. Current faculty, when they're hired, when they get tenure, it's a contractual relationship. They know what's coming. They know the rules they're under. They know the process they are under if it's challenged. This is different. This is you or me sitting in our offices one day and getting a letter from our alma mater telling us that someone has raised a question about the ethics of our degree. Totally different. Some of that's expectation. But it's all about process. Now, there is a property right there. In that case, in that situation, it's similar. But the key is, can there be enough process, A, when there's no impartial arbiter, and B, when you're applying rules? Again, these rules of Texas State specifically, I mean, they're in the record. They specifically apply by their terms to students only, or they specifically apply to tenured faculty only. KE is neither. Can you have due process if you're applying rules that don't apply to somebody? No, you can't.
If we or assume for a moment that TSU does have the power to revoke degrees, then, you know, you mentioned this before, remand back to the trial court, and then what happens next?
Well, so that's a great question. And I can't say I've ever been in one of those remanded situations to know for sure what happens. But I think what happens is, at that point, it becomes an issue for the trial court. It's an issue, by the way, this court could decide, because I think it's a legal issue. Whether someone got due process or not, I think is a legal issue. You could decide it. But I think the normal course would be like we did in SO, which is to give a trial court the first crack at it. Because here, all we're arguing about is immunity. Really, that's all we're here about today. So once you decide whether there's immunity, it goes back to the trial court. But I think ultimately it's a legal issue, whether they got due process or not. To go back to the beginning, this is heads that I win, tails you lose. And that's an unacceptable position to take when you're dealing with a private citizen's constitutional rights. And the way to avoid letting them take that position is to affirm the trial court's order. Thank you.
So four quick points I want to make on rebuttal. First, as to reinstatement and the Nelson case, if you read the Nelson opinion, the Fifth Circuit doesn't find that it acknowledges the state's position that this is a distinct act that happened in the past, and the rationale for allowing that to go forward was simply because of a panel opinion that was bound by. And since Nelson, the Fifth Circuit has expressly declined to extend that outside of the public employment context. And they cite no Fifth Circuit case or no Supreme Court case or no Texas state that has likewise extended that public employment exception to ex parte Young broadly or to ultra vires. And there's no way to write this opinion allowing for this to go forward without directly contradicting American Youth Works, this court's opinion in American Youth Works, and the rationale expressed in the 2017 SO opinion. As to the argument that we didn't address the due process claim, they have pled their claims, and this is at the record, clerk's record at 541 in the third amended petition, as an ultra vires claim under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act that has two ultra vires allegations. First, that we don't have the authority to revoke a degree, and second, that we violate due process. And the Supreme Court in Heinrich, and then later in Patel, has expressly determined that under the UDGA, there are two ways that there are two types of claims that get by the state's immunity. First, a claim that a statute has been constitutional is unconstitutional. That's not the case here. The other is an ultra vires claim where the allegations that we've acted outside of our authority or violated their constitutional rights. The due process claim is by its very nature, as the courts explained Patel and Heinrich, an ultra vires claim, and it's bound by Heinrich's ultra vires requirement.
Well, but we don't have any APA issues here, right?
We do not.
Okay.
Third, as to due process, what I haven't heard is any allegation that the process that we have given them is somehow under the constitutional floor expressed by Thann. What I've heard is that the university cannot provide impartial proceeding, but if that's the case, then a decision saying that would upend all sorts of university process, because the university provides due process in all sorts of contexts.
Well, what do we do about the fact that KE was neither a student and was nor was she faculty? I don't even know which it is. Faculty. I mean, What do we do with that?
That doesn't go to whether she received due process. What Dan sets out is the three requirements of process: notice, an explanation of the evidence, and a right to present your story. Through the multi-layers of process, it's undisputed.
Well, but I think that what about having it between, you know, outside of the university system?
So Texas courts and the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that academic decisions by universities are best left at the first instance to those universities, and courts are imperfect places to have those discussions. That's why there's generally academic deference.
And I think that the decision to confer the degree was uniquely within the university's authority to do so. And I think a court couldn't say, oh, wait, you know, you have to give me my degree now. But once there, then the due process is what steps in. Is that
right? So then the university.
So then, why is the university the only ones who can? Why are the universities the ones that are uniquely qualified to take it away?
Because inherent in this discussion, inherent in the university's decision, is an academic decision. It's whether this degree, whether the allegations of fraudulent data were enough to say that that the dissertation was fraudulently
Are you suggesting a court can't recognize fraud when it sees it?
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying is this Texas courts and the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly said that academic decisions are best left in the first instance to universities, okay, and deference should be given to universities in making those determinations. And that's all we ask here. And the hypothetical that this would somehow there'd be some parade of horribles, or 30 years down the line we could revoke degrees. In that scenario, there'd be significant due process concerns. That's not what we're asking for. We're asking for, in this limited scenario, that the university did not act ultra vires, and that plaintiff's claim is impermissibly retrospective, consistent with this court's prior opinions and Texas Supreme Court opinions. And unless there's any further questions, we'd ask that the court reverse and render judgment for the state.
Your point about decisions best left to academic decisions best left to academia, you have any case authority you could specifically call us to?
Yeah, I can.
Either presently or later.
I will. Yeah.
So it sounds like an invitation if you'd like to submit a post-submission brief.
I will, Your Honor.
Yeah, and that, of course, means y'all get to do the same as well without having to pay the whatever it is, since we just asked for it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did you have a question as well?
I was just going to say, would you agree, though? I mean, what you're asking is reverse and render, but we could reverse and remand, and then these due process claims could continue to be litigated at the trial court, right?
Yes, theoretically. I don't think there's any need to, because I think if you look at Dan and the floor of due process, it's undisputed. What the undisputed facts here is that we've allowed for through multiple steps, notice of the charges, an opportunity for her to meet with the committees, to have counsel, to cross-examine witness, to hire experts, to have those experts examine the university's evidence. That is far more than any court has ever set for the minimal floor due process. And those facts are undisputed. So yes, the court could reverse and remand, but the court should decide just on those undisputed facts that due process, the minimum floor due process, has been met in this instance.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the cause will be submitted. This court is adjourned. Thank you for compelling argument on all sides. Thank you.